Okay, you will have noticed looking at the schedule that a week from Friday there's going to be an exam, which will cover the lectures through next Wednesday. So the people who are writing wikis on the last lecture should try to get them ahead done by noon the next day rather than by midnight, so people have a chance to use them. So the topics will include, as we've said, functional groups and X-ray diffraction and one-dimensional quantum mechanics, which we're getting to today, and one-electron atoms, which we'll get to a little later. And it will cover this material in sections 1 through 5 of the quantum web page. And a particularly helpful tool for this is this program that you can download named Ervin Meets Goldilocks. And the other material that we've talked about in lecture is fair game, too. But these are sort of the main substantive topics. And when you download that thing and the instructions that go with it, you'll see that there are problems to be done. You can do them as a group, as you have before, do on Monday, and they have to do with Goldilocks there. In order to learn how to use this program, which is, it's not so hard to use, but probably you need a little help, and Peter's going to go through that tomorrow night at the discussion section so you can get started on that. It takes some thought, so get started on them soon. And I'll give a review session Wednesday night next week. I'll get a room for that and let you know. Okay, so we were talking last time about this molecule whose structure, whose electron density distribution was determined very, very precisely. And remember, the center of each of those spheres is going to be where the atoms are, and they knew them so precisely, they knew them within plus and minus 2/1000ths of an angstrom. Okay, and we saw last time that if you made a slice through the electron density there, it looked like this, and you could see in this difference density map all the carbon-carbon bonds, all the carbon-hydrogen bonds, everything looks just hunky-dory there. That's nothing surprising, except that you can determine things so precisely. But if you do this slice, a vertical slice through the molecule that goes through the orange atoms, as you see there, that cross-section looks like this. So over on the right, you see the bonds among these atoms, right there, there, and there. Up at the top, you see the bond between a nitrogen here and the carbon. That's fine. You also see the bonds to hydrogen that aren't shown on the left in the first picture. And you see the lone pair on nitrogen. So everything looks just right. Now, what are these two things here? Anybody got an idea? What are those two bits of electron density on this particular plane, a vertical plane cut through the molecule? Kevin? They're these bonds over here that you've sliced through, got cross sections of those bonds. Okay? So that's just fine, except for one thing. Do you see what's missing? Sagar? Pardon me? There should be a cross section of this bond, right? But it's not there. There's a missing bond. So this is one of the aspects of pathology in this structure. As far as Lewis is considered, there's supposed to be a bond there and there isn't. And if we take a different slice that also goes through that same green bond there, through the three atoms that form a ring, it looks like this. And again, that bond is just not there. Right? And there's something else funny here. Do you see what else is funny about the other bonds in the ring? Henry? Maybe they're a little bit weak, but that's not the main thing. Yeah. Can't hear very well.
The bond doesn't seem to be in between.
The bond's not between the atoms. It's out to the side. Those bonds are bent. That's not something that we anticipated. So here's another element of pathology. And in 3 weeks after we've studied the real theory of bonding, then you'll see why those things work that way. But Lewis certainly wouldn't have predicted it. Okay, so Lewis pairs and octets provide a very good bookkeeping device for keeping track of valence and making sure that all the electrons are there. But they're hopelessly crude when it comes to describing the true electron distribution. There is electron sharing, as we saw last time, about 5%, 1/20th of a pair of electrons is built up between the two nuclei, over and above what you would expect to be there if it was just atoms that were overlapping, right? And there are unshared pairs, but they're even a little less than a 1/20th of a pair of electrons. Okay, so this leaves us wondering if there's a better theory of bonding, maybe even one that would have numbers associated with it, which Lewis so far doesn't. Okay? And the answer is yes, and that it's chemical quantum mechanics. Now, you can study quantum mechanics in physics. You can study it chemistry, of course. You may be able to study it in literature, for all I know. Maybe deconstructionists talk about quantum mechanics. And different people take different points of view about quantum mechanics. We're doing chemical quantum mechanics, so we're interested in molecules and bonds, not primarily in atoms that are just floating around in the ether someplace. Okay, so physicists and chemists take a slightly different point of view, and if you take quantum mechanics and physics, they'll teach you different things. And it'll be much more mathematical than what we teach here, but it will not be more rigorous. What I'm telling you is the truth. Okay, but I'm not requiring you to know how to do differential equations. Okay, so it all started in 1926. Remember, at the same time that Lewis and Thomson and James Jeans and other physicists were disputing Coulomb's law, at the same time Schrödinger developed a completely new approach to understanding how small things behave, or anything behaves. And it was based on the wave equation, which I'm pretty sure you've heard of. Here's Erwin Schrödinger in Zurich the year before, in 1925. He's this guy in the middle. He's 38 years old. He looks a little bit like a wimp here at the swimming bath. He's a professor of physics at the University of Zurich, but he's not a very prominent professor of physics. He's working on color theory. Okay. But Felix Bloch, who was an undergraduate student at the University of Zurich then, wrote on the 50th anniversary of this discovery in Physics Today an account of what he had observed when he was a first-year student there. He said, "Once at the end of a colloquium, I heard Debye," this is Peter Debye, who was the main professor at the ETH, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, saying something like, "Schrödinger, you're not working right now on very important problems anyway. Why don't you tell us sometime about that thesis of de Broglie?" So in one of the next colloquia, Schrödinger gave a beautifully clear account of how de Broglie associated a wave with a particle. When he had finished, Debye casually remarked that he thought this way of talking was rather childish. He had learned that to deal properly with waves, one had to have a wave equation to describe the wave. It sounded rather trivial and didn't seem to make a great impression, but Schrödinger evidently thought a bit about the idea afterwards. Just a few weeks later, he gave another talk in the colloquium, which he started by saying, "My colleague Debye suggested that one should have a wave equation. Well, I have found one." And this is his equation. That's not the way he wrote it. He wrote it with complex numbers. He wrote IH psi equals E psi. But this is our version of it. Okay, so H psi equals E psi is the Schrödinger equation. Now, just 6 years later, here is Schrödinger looking much more spiffy in his fancy puttees and fur collar and so on, with his bow tie slightly askew. And he's at a tram stop in Stockholm, where he's gone to collect the Nobel Prize for this work, right? Together with Paul Dirac and Werner Heisenberg, who who were much younger than he was. In fact, the women accompanying them are Dirac's and Heisenberg's mother on either side here. That's Heisenberg's mother, that's Dirac's mother. But this is Schrödinger's wife, who's sort of looking out the corner of her eye at Schrödinger, I think wondering what he was doing. Because in fact, they say that he devised the equation while he was up in the mountains with his mistress. And in fact, in 1933, his daughter was born, but not by his wife, by this other woman. So he was of questionable morals, I think, but he did a good equation. Okay, so the Schrödinger equation is H psi equals E psi. Okay, so what's the psi? Right, the psi is, as you've heard, a wave function. Okay, so what's a wave function? Well, you're not alone in wondering that. This is 1931, so Heisenberg's group in Leipzig. And here, in fact, is Felix Bloch, the guy who wrote this account that we just read, who's come there to be a graduate student. So here are people. This guy's going to be a real bigwig in Cambridge in the UK. This guy here is going to be the chairman of the physics department at MIT. So these are very distinguished people. They know they're going to be very distinguished. They're working on a very important project in trying to understand and apply quantum mechanics. So they're all looking at the camera to record this moment, except for two people, one of whom is Bloch. Right? Now, Bloch is a distinguished guy. In 1952, he got the Nobel Prize for inventing NMR. Okay? But what's he looking at instead of the camera? He's trying to figure out what psi is. Okay? Now, in fact, he had written a poem in 1926 together with Erich Huckel during an excursion on the Lake of Zurich by young physicists. So they made up these little doggerel poems. And this one is, Erwin with his psi can do calculations, quite a few. We only wish that we could glean an inkling of what psi could mean, because no one knew what psi meant. Okay? And in fact, even Schrödinger was never really comfortable with what psi really means. And in 1952, he gave a talk called What is Matter? And if we're luckier today than we were last time, the machine will work. So he didn't know, right? And in fact, he went to his grave, not perhaps really knowing what psi was. This is his grave in Altbach in Austria. And you see, there's this question mark on his gravestone, or his grave marker. Okay, so it's too much to expect right at the beginning to know what psi is, right? First, we'll learn how to find this function and how to use it, right? And later, we'll learn what it means. If all these Nobel laureates didn't know, it's too much for us to know right at the beginning. But we can still find it and use it. So it's a tool at the beginning. Okay, so psi is a function. And the thing you'll want to know is, what's it a function of? What do you put in here? What are the values which, if given to this function, it gives you back something else? It gives you a number. You know, a function is something that, like a sine of x. You give me what x is, and I tell you what the sine of x is if I'm a function, right? So what are the arguments of the function is the question. Now, the functions have, there are many different wave functions, and they have names. But the names are not what they're a function of. It's just which function it is, like sine is a function, cosine is a function, tangent is a function, x squared is a function. right? So those are names of functions, not what they're a function of. Okay, now the names of these functions could be things like N, L, and M, quantum numbers, or 1S, or 3D, XY, or sigma, or pi star. Those are all names of functions, but it's not what it's a function of. It's not what number you put in order to get a number out of the function, right? It's a function of the position of a particle. Or if the problem involves many particles, like an atom does, a nucleus and electrons, then you have the positions of all the particles are what you have to put in, and the wave function will give you back one number. If you say electron 1 is here, electron 2 is here, and the nucleus is here, then it will give you a number. And if you say the electron is here, here, and here, it'll give you a different number. But what it's a function of is position of the particles you're interested in. Okay. Now, and sometimes it's also a function of time. The original equation Schrödinger wrote had time as a variable. And if the particles have spin, it could be a function of their spin. But for our purposes, we don't have to talk about that, so we'll be a little simpler. When you go to physical chemistry, you'll get that stuff. Okay, so if you have n particles, there are 3n arguments. How do I get that? Yeah, Derek? X, Y, Z for each particle, if we're in three dimensions. There can be as many as 4n plus 1, because if the particles had a spin, it would be 4 instead of 3, and if you had time also, that would be plus 1. So it could be that many, but we're not going to talk about that many. Okay? We'll focus first, you'll be delighted to hear, on one particle and one